Tonight, we have a very, very special guest, young gentleman who I have known for a number of years, and I'm sure most of you know the name. I mean, you all know in what relationship he has played in the musical world. And we are very happy to welcome Brian Epstein of England to WOFM and our microphones. Brian, it's a delight to have you on the show.
Welcome to America.
And all that kind of jazz. Yeah. There's so many questions that I have to ask of you, and so many things that I want to ask. I think that perhaps we'll just do them as they come along.
Ask what you like.
All right. To begin with, what everyone seems to have had a new direction. Everyone has gone through their own matriculation, I guess, and have reached a certain maturity in musically, I'm speaking, and able to articulate a whole new meaning as far as concept of music and musicianship. And your involvement in England, not only with the Beatles, but with many other groups as well, and your own career, since I haven't really sat to speak with you about this in any length, the year's difference, while it has been great in many fields, how has it changed as far as your own thinking, your own direction? Has there been a change for you?
Well, it's changed because I suppose that I've gained more confidence. Because when I first came over here with Billy Kramer, I only knew two people in New York. And then after that, of course, in the beginning of 1964, it all broke out, and that was when we first met. And really, it was beyond everything that, because I didn't know what was going on. It was, one acted sensibly, with common sense, as much as anything else. But the success with the records was so unbelievable, and the acceptance of the boys was so great that one didn't quite know what was going on. So in between times, one's been able to find out what has been going on and what has taken place, and one's seen progression, not only with the Beatles, but with lots of other people. So I think things are much better now than they were
when you first came over. This has been a... being in the midst of it, I seem to notice it all the time that the times that I had traveled with you all, that it was almost like you weren't involved in it, like you were just observing this fantasy. It's like it was very, as you said, very unreal. It was just too immense or too big. And I think, as a manager, I've noticed that this happened. I don't think you went into the management business, I gather, as just for the sake that this was your business and your livelihood, but really that you were you appreciated music, and I think you dug music and loved music a great deal.
Well, I did. I sold records over a counter in a Liverpool store for a long time, 6 years, I think, and it was only that I was getting bored with doing that, because I could almost anticipate demand, that I went away for a little while, to Spain actually, and came back, and then the Beatle thing happened. But that was a long time ago, that was 1961. It took a long time to break through, and I think today it takes a long time to break through with anything that's really important. Nothing that's really important is broken through very quickly. Except, well, you can take in England. Many of your listeners probably won't know about Jimi Hendrix, who, by the way, has nothing to do with me. But you can take, for example, Jimi, and he's broken through big now, and I suppose to the general public in England, it looks as though it's an overnight success, but no star or success is born overnight. Jimmy hung around the village and around Detroit and around masses of places throughout the States before anything really happened to him, before someone took an interest and brought him over to England, and now he is very important.
Well, we have heard a lot about him. I think what we'll do right about here is let's play a record which is not released here in the States, or is it? Is his
what,
version?
Hey Joe?
Hey Joe? Jimmy's? Well, we have it, because, I mean, I guess it's the English record that we do.
Well, I wouldn't have known whether it was or not.
Yeah. Well, we have this, and I think let's give our listeners an opportunity to hear what Brian's talking about. This is Jimi Hendrix's version of Hey Joe.
But that is not representative of Jimi Hendrix. I mean, Jimi Hendrix is much better, you know, than Hey Joe, I think. It's good. Hey Joe's good, but I think that he is better, and he's a great performer. So,
You're telling me that he plays a guitar with...
With his teeth, with his feet, with his amplifier. He bashes it about, but it's not a gimmick thing. It's not smashing up guitars, which a lot of people do. It's just that he can play with his teeth. He is an ace guitarist.
Speaking of musicianship, the one thing that I guess about the Beatles, and I think that I'm sure that there are many listeners here, and I'd like to get to a nitty-gritty type of questions and get that out of the way so that we can proceed into other areas. The Beatles and your relationship and your projection, as far as they are concerned, because we still get letters. They are broken up, and it's more or less. Sometimes people hear news, sometimes they hear just smattering of news. And I felt that there's no one who is closer to the situation and more involved. And I thought perhaps you'd just tell us what the present status is as far as the Beatles and their career and your own involvement.
Well, the most amazing thing about this trip is that I haven't been to America since there was those strange rumors about them breaking up. And I didn't really know how big this rubbishy rumor had got out. You know, it was all beyond and above the five of us. I didn't realize that. I mean, I was coming over on the airplane, and the hostess, who was very pretty and very nice, came and sat down.
That's nice.
And the first thing she said was, well, they're breaking up now, aren't they? And this was fait accompli, you know. One thought she had decided that this had happened in her own mind, and what are you going to America for?
Mm-hmm.
But this wasn't true at all. There was no breakup, it was just a rumour. And I thought that I scotched the rumours in London with various announcements, and even the boys said, you know, there was nothing in it. And I even got them not to say anything about it, because it was all so stupid.
Well, the one thing which you probably didn't realise, and I remember, you know, there was always a rumor each week about the Beatles back in the more hysterical days in 64, 65, and the printed stories about Paul getting married and, of course, him ending up being the only one that hasn't been married. And so that most of the time on the air was trying to find out what the true facts were. But here it really had developed to a point where I was even starting to be brainwashed. They had talked about, well, you're no longer going to be connected, and they're going their way. And there was a story here last week in a magazine or in a newspaper. It was in a newspaper, which stated about Paul saying, well, it's all over for us now. It's definitely over. And he's going to be spending his time in a recording studio making records and puttering around the house and all that kind of jazz. And then the rumors got into more within the trade and went into the public about the fact that they had a new manager, or they weren't going to have a manager, and maybe they were going to make a picture, and that all of these things about George going to India and doing a whole bit there with the sitar, and that it was hung up on the Indian music, and that John was going to do a picture, and follow a career as an actor. And so I think that it's about time that I think that people should know what has happened. I mean, what has taken place in the past, say, month or so with regard to new contracts and all that kind of thing.
The last month or so is quite different from the last months or so. I think they had a very hard time last year, you know, touring-wise. I think it was the hardest ever because we visited countries which we'd never been to before. Japan, the Philippines and all that, that broke out there, which was very difficult and very hard, and I accept responsibility, but it was actually none of our faults. And then we had the American tour and the Christ business, which was sort of a thing which was taken out of context, which we were all very worried about. So that I don't think that it's wonder that any of them, after that, took what you might call long vacations. Paul did, in fact, write a film score. George did go to India for several weeks. And John did make a film, which is very good, by the way. And even Ringo wanted the time just to spend to contemplate. But this is all over and changed, and they're working very hard, actually, at the moment. I spoke to Paul this afternoon, and I was surprised, actually, because off the new album, I thought that I know of three tracks. I've heard three tracks, and they've actually they've got nine done, he told me. But the nine have got to be completed. You know, there's various things that have got to be put onto them and so on. So nine is pretty well near the mark. I don't know whether in that nine he's including the two at the moment. Probably for America, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
They'll put the singles on, although I wish they wouldn't. We always have arguments with Capital as to whether they should put the singles
Penny
on
Lane
or not.
Strawberry.
But I hope they don't, because it's Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane is selling here better than our last few singles, and those are pretty big. So it'd be very nice for America if we didn't put on the two singles.
Include something
and
else.
Include something else, something fresh.
Mm-hmm.
Because the album is going to be, well, I didn't like to sort of be particularly swanky about it, but it is going to be great.
The one thing which I felt, and I want to ask you about this, so we get into the specifics, and then ask you a question about their attitude and your own personal attitude about the fact that a lot of people now will pick out of their material, like Norwegian Wood, which we play a great deal, or I've just seen the face, mm-hmm. a lot of the great things out of the Rubber Soul album,
yeah.
and the tremendous reaction we had to songs like Tomorrow Never Knows, and there's one tune which is a big favorite of our audience that Paul does.
Eleanor Rigby?
Well, no, because that's very commercial, and that's mm-hmm. been a tremendous success, and it's nominated for... Did it win the...
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
It did.
It won, yeah, okay.
I heard you. Say so.
The particular tune which I think in the album was... it starts, Our Day Breaks and He Wakes... What is that? Well, anyhow, I'll think of the title probably after we're off the air. But it shows that they have a definite idea and purpose in mind, musically, both expressing themselves as musicians and as artists of doing certain kinds of numbers.
Yes, they're doing great things in the studio, and they're working every night in the studio. They really are. Every single night. And if the sessions have ever been cancelled in the last month or so, they've been for a particular reason. They just have Saturday and Sunday nights off, like anybody else.
Right. Do they... but they most likely will do another film?
We're going to build a television show around the album. to showcase it, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, we're going to make a film.
A film.
Which I'm very anxious and keen about. And we have ideas. And when I say we have ideas, I don't say that vaguely. We've got a definite idea, which needs developing. And we've got definite ideas as to who should develop it. And we've got definite ideas about what sort of director should be involved.
Did the thought of doing a personal appearance tour, we had quite a long conversation with Paul Simon the last time that he was on, and some of the things, of course, that happens to every artist who gets acceptance, but particularly, I mean, you have a few phenomena that happen. Sinatra, Presley, and the Beatles, I guess, were the big three of the past 20 years, anyhow. But in either case, I would imagine that where they've already done that bit of having 50-some-odd or 60-some-odd thousand people in a ballpark go hysterical and go out there and just play, and as the boys often said, you know, they were watching the people just as much as the people watching them, just the reaction, you know.
Yes.
But it would seem that since they're doing so many groovy things and writing so many things and have so much to say, that it would seem to me that maybe one of the reasons that they wouldn't want to do a tour of that kind of tour again would be because I think they've got something more to say than getting mass hysteria.
I think what you said, which was most salient, if they like that on this program, is the kind of tour. I don't think that you get any one of them or me to categorically state that they will never appear in public again. Not because of the financial aspect, but because it will be very difficult to progress from those sort of tours. And in any case, this is my personal point of view, how creatively satisfactory for them are those tours, except in terms of finance. And they don't really think too much about that. They leave that to me anyway. But one understands it very well. So there's no reason why they shouldn't appear in public again. But I don't think that it will be in the concept that we've known previously.
Well, I think, too, that that's just in keeping with... that's why in getting your idea and your concept seems to be moving to have a definite rapport with those of the boys, because I know that you always sit together and talk things over, and it's great that you're both moving, you in your managerial capacity and they in their artistic capacity seem to be, you know, going through the same or traveling the same road. I find that this has happened to everybody. I in the book that I wrote, and I only say it because I'm not even interested in that. I've done that. I'm thinking of the next one. But I think the one thing that they did is that they had set a pattern. Their attitude probably was the most important thing. Their approach to people, all kinds of people, whether it be the press or royalty or at certain ambassadorial parties, and they're completely being unimpressed except by the person and what it was they said,
right.
had a definite impact.
Good.
All
good.
Really did have an impact, and I think their attitude and being able to not take themselves seriously. In other words, hey, and I remember the stars of yesteryear, and you sit back and you play star. Mm. The boys have never done that. And I think their attitude has been probably the one single force which has had a tremendous amount of influence, not only on musicians, thank you, and performers, but also on the average American fella and gal in their approach to life.
Yeah.
And their demand, really, for honesty, because I think that's one thing, of all the things that if anyone would ask me about my relationship, or knowing them and knowing you, was a complete, honest approach. I mean, George particularly, I mean, hasn't never made a statement which you could say was dependent upon something else. I mean, always knew where you stood.
Any statement which they've made, taken out of context, is difficult for people to accept. But on the other hand, they do speak honestly.
Right. The Maureen Cleave thing, and I know perhaps when you said that, you perhaps had referred to the statement about Christ, which by now, just for your own edification, as far as our listeners are concerned, since it was taken out of context, and I did read the entire statement at the time that it happened, it's something which I think a lot of people concur with, so much so that the second part of my book, which I'm doing, is all about religion. Its second part is called God Is Not Dead, The Church Is. And in it, I think John Lennon has probably prompted more things, more of a realization, because all throughout the United States, in every kind of denomination, people are reaching out I speak about the church itself and the progressive people of all denominations, the progressive clergy, are looking for ideas, not from theologians, but rather from people who say, well, how can we relate?
Yes.
They've done contrivance. They've tried, but it's come out as a contrivance. They played rock and roll music in churches, you know, to attract the young. But then when you get them there, what is it? Are you relating what you're doing? And I think what he has said is true, that they have lost out in getting. There have been more people buying Beatle records and going to see Beatle movies, and then there has been new people going to join and become a member of a church. But
I would think that the thing that upset John most about that was that the initial interview, was done in his own home with Maureen Cleave, who we've known. Well, you probably met her on
we traveled on the very first tour, yes, right.
And we've known her very, very well, and we like her very much. We all like her very much. And, you know, he said these things, and she was right to report them. But I think that what upset John more than anything else was that hundreds of people were hurt by that. And I think that John is a very sympathetic person.
He is.
Incredibly sympathetic. And the last thing that he would want to do would be to hurt anybody's inner feelings, however much he may
feel
sort of. But this is a basic thing with John, not to go and hurt other people, not to go and smash other people up.
It was amazing, because when I heard it was Maureen, I had met her in England. In fact, she did a nice piece on me, and I know that she was one of the big Beatle fans.
Yes, and she was upset herself.
I can imagine.
I mean, she was calling me when I flew over here to see what was what before they came. She was on the phone every few seconds saying, what could I do, and how can I help, and so on and so forth.
Well, it seems, however, though, Brian, and I think it becomes a matter of fact, that the press is not particularly interested in trying to get an explanation and give a full explanation. They had something sensational to go on.
Yes.
They had something finally to put down. These kids who play loud music, as far as they're concerned, those people who are really turned off to today, and I'm not talking about being a hippie or anything, but I mean really of today's world. I think it was their duty and their obligation was to have the first person who should have been interviewed, should have been Maureen Cleave, to write what she had said, which they took out of context. But they weren't looking for that. I mean, you heard about DJs across the country, like they banned Beatle records. I mean, that, you know, that's like, it's, yes. If you saw that
when
in a grade B movie,
Beatle
you wouldn't see
Lennon
it.
Or Lennon or something like that. And that's good press news.
Yeah.
It's good press news today, and if they sell two records only with their next single, it'll still be... Beatle news is still important. And, as, you know, why this thing happens is because... I don't know whether it's true in America, but it seems that it's true in Europe, that the people behind the press are out of touch with today. They don't realise that things like radio and television have almost taken their place. And Armstrong Jones, Lord Snowden, said the other day that he couldn't understand why this rumour about him breaking up with Princess Margaret had got out at all. I mean, his actual quotes were pretty hot because... they were so genuine, really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he talked about the gutter press of Europe had been saying this for years, ever since they first married. He was saying that sort of thing, and he couldn't understand it. Of course, they hadn't said it in England because it hadn't broken big enough in Europe. But he did say that, and I think that he had a right to say that, because it's just sensational names and sensational stories to be built up upon.
I think perhaps what you say is best exemplified, that radio and TV as information sources. When you write something in a newspaper, it's hearsay and rumor, and people... it's the printed word, and tradition and years, I guess, teach you, well, this is it, you know. After a while, people, for example, are not believing the history books either, because they don't believe that the true story has been written about the American Indian, for example. I mean, or with the Negro and what happened there.
Yes, but they probably have, because the people that wrote those books... are not sort of cheap press.
No.
Trying to sell papers on a daily basis.
Well, even there are, let me say, certain things that were kept out that weren't included, that should have been. I'm not saying that they had written in that point.
True.
Right.
Yes.
But here in the press, the reason that radio and TV is has taken up a great deal of slack is that people can hear it for themselves, see it for themselves, hear the entire conversation for themselves. Here in newspaper, they write whatever they want.
Exactly.
They take you out of context,
exactly.
And therefore they can paint. Even though Lord Snowden said it, it seemed like a sort of half-hearted kind of routine denial, because they did not issue the full text of what he had said. They just wrote...
No, but some of the things that they quoted him as saying were okay.
Mm-hmm.
I thought so,
mm-hmm.
Anyway.
We're going to take a couple of moments out, and I think this is about a time to play some Beatles sounds, and I'd like to wrap that up. Some of the sounds, of course, that we'll play, we'll do a little medley of Beatles sounds for you. An interesting thing, there was a survey of which we pay no particular attention to on our show, only because we don't believe it. We believe in our own audience's reaction. And when the Strawberry Fields Forever and Penny Lane came out, we ran a sampling here, and we took something, a couple of thousand votes within a 40-minute period. And Strawberry Fields Forever had won by, about 100 and some odd votes the first day it came on.
This is extremely interesting.
And then we waited until the survey came out this past week, and Penny Lane became number one.
Yes.
And we ran the same survey, and again, Strawberry Fields won. So that, as far as we're concerned, if Penny Lane is number one, according to our audience, Strawberry Fields is
too. Well, this is just what we knew even before it came out, that Strawberry Fields was perhaps the one which some of our friends would go for.
Mm-hmm.
But Penny Lane was definitely the more commercial, whatever that means.
Yeah. Well, here's all that, the interpretations of Beatles and the spirit of the Beatles 67 sound. In playing some of the music we have just played, the Beatles sounds of 1967, is there any kind, would you say that there is a compatibility in the forthcoming album with those two sounds, or are there further expressions of types of music, yes, and lyrical content? There are.
Yes.
Okay, good.
And it's absolutely amazing. I can't believe it myself.
Well, they are amazing in the sense that I think they personified their impetus. I think it was only the Beatles whose every record became so different in its approach and of exploring new things, but saying something which is so attuned to today and what's happening today and so aware of today, that this has made for the greatest amount of fusion between the folk field, the rock field,
yeah,
so that there is everybody's into everybody else's mind and into everybody else's thoughts and are freer. They're no longer very... There was a great deal of prejudice. I don't know how it was in England, but it has been a great deal of prejudice here in the past about the various categories of music. I think the Beatles helped a great deal in starting an impetus that broke down these so-called prejudices and barriers so that everybody could appreciate what everybody else was doing. I even had acknowledged that the one person, John and George and Paul, who had made me aware of that Dylan existed back around 64.
Yes.
And the fact that a Dylan was a big fan of the Beatles, and the Beatles were fans of Dylan, and then Dylan not caring if they booed at Newport because all of a sudden he electrified his backgrounds,
yeah,
and the Beatles not saying, hey, well, this record's sold, let's stay with the I Want to Hold Your Hand bit. They were really expressing, you know, whatever they felt musically.
Yes, well, one of the things which the Beatles have taught me, and they've taught me many things, and one of the biggest hang-ups that I ever had, personally, was to categorize people. And they do not categorize people or things or music. There's nothing which is bad. There are some things which are trite and lousy, but one doesn't necessarily have to categorize them. I mean, the Monkees, who are enormous here and enormous in England, good luck, great. Mm-hmm. I think they're, you know, I love their records. And we met them in England, and they're nice guys. So you don't categorize them as being, you know, when they first erupted in England, there was quite a lot of knocking in the press, which was supposed, I suppose, to sort of say, well, here we are, the great British people with our beautiful Beatles. Well, we are. You know, we do have our beautiful Beatles. But there's nothing the matter with the Monkees. And the Monkees have given a great boost to the industry and the kids and everybody, and everyone's buying their records, and there's nothing the matter with that at all.
No, I think it is, however, very wise if they would come right out and, you know, express the fact that, fine, hey, we don't play the instruments. We are just learning to play the instruments. We didn't make our own tracks.
But
we're learning.
But they did say that.
But
they
did
say
it now.
In London, anyway.
Yeah, they are now. And like I think it was David Jones said to me, he said, you know, thank goodness they were yelling that much so they didn't have to hear us in their first concert, you know, as far as playing is concerned.
There's a lot more in it than that.
Right.
I mean, I think they want to do more things themselves.
Right. I
very much indeed.
Yes, that's true.
But then I, as a manager, can't help but admiring the
way they were handled, yes,
and the way they were handled that went behind them.
Uh-huh.
Even though I wouldn't ever have done it myself, because I'm just not that sort of person. But I can't help but admire it, obviously.
Did you... there are so many things happening. I mean, it's great, really. One of the reasons I wanted to get back on the air is that there's so much being done, being said, so many exciting things happening. And there are a couple of new groups who you were involved with.
Mm-hmm.
One is Cream, and the other the Who. And I thought perhaps you'd tell us a little about them, because I know as soon as I mentioned a couple of the groups around, there was without them having a big smash record here, there was a lot of excitement. I mean, tremendous amount of interest, particularly with The Who, because of they had one record out. Now the interest is climbing. We're among the more erudite for the Cream, who have heard about the fact that Eric Clapton is in the group and recognizes one of the great guitar players. Could you tell us just a little about...
Well, these are good people. I come into them by my organization in London, for which I'm called a capitalist. But I don't really sort of have that much, but I'm very proud to be associated with them, particularly the, you know, the Cream and the Who, because mm-hmm. they are rated by everyone, including me, as being tremendously important. And I've had both. I've been doing these Sunday night concerts at the Savile Theatre, which is my theatre in London, and this has been a tremendous success. And the Who and the Cream have both topped the bills there to very, very successful audiences. I mean, packed out houses. Mm-hmm. And they were fantastic, unbelievable.
Wasn't it the Who that was the originators of taking the lead guitar player, taking his guitar and just smashing it to smithereens and the...
Yes, they were. But yes, they were. They didn't actually do it when they appeared at the Savile. Not because I think they were inhibited or anything, but just because they did a very great show. Mm-hmm. And they didn't need to do that.
Any gimmicks, yeah.
To show how good they were. But they did, in fact, put up such a fantastic show. And as did the Cream. The Cream were unbelievable. And I think when you have them over here that you'll like them very much. I think your listeners, all of whom I hope come to see the show.
Well, it starts March 25th, and we're looking forward to having them both here. And there's been a great deal of activity here. There's going to be a lot of press because we want to make them feel right at home because of the fact we've heard so much about them. In fact, we're going to play The Cream and the Who right now. My guest is Brian Epstein, and this is WRFM. Here on Murray the K's nightly little soiree. We hope that you out there in Radio Land get an opportunity now to... Yeah, it's some place out there within that listens in, I hope, each night. But... Thank you. But the most important thing was to create in our minds and in the minds of those listeners, you know, exactly what the story is with regard to Epi, and as the boys refer to him, and the story with regard to the Beatles breaking up and another rumor, again, which has really had a chance to seep through, and to this day, the people still thinking that they are breaking up. So that we've really cleared that up. Would you, in just projecting now, not you yourself as someone who loves music, has some very definitive ideas, is there anything that you see as the next step? For example, a show maybe with Lennon and McCartney music, or a kind of new type of concert, or something that would be, that you felt is the next step for them. Is there anything in your mind now, or is there is it just in the thought stages?
No, I can't foresee anything, because one works along with things, and I can't really see a new concept, but I've no doubt that there will be, just as all the factors are coming together towards making the new film right now. And I think that they'll be successful. But one doesn't foresee years ahead. People ask, sort of, what's the new sound going to be? What's this? Actually, the best thing that anybody ever said about that was once when I was watching a concert in Liverpool, which is definitely for FM listeners, which Sir Thomas Beecham was conducting. And, you know, he was quite a character. And he just turned round to the audience, and I don't know what I can't remember what he was talking about, but he was talking about great music and good music and music that lived and so on. And he said, you've just got to get down to basics, that sort of the music that lives are really the great tunes. You can have the sounds as well. And I think we are developing the sounds today and the techniques, but you've got to have the tunes too.
That's so important. I think that as it has happened in the past, of just one event, I guess, will lead to another. I'm trying an entirely new concept of a stage presentation for today's music. We'll soon find out if it works in its present form. I'm excited about it. I believe in it. But I think, too, that the boys are very creative in that sense of probably when the time comes, they'll make their move. In other words, a tour or a personal appearances have not been completely ruled out.
No, because just like recording, they're taking much longer of their own volition, I suppose, to make records today. I mean, they've been in the studios now for weeks. And I think this is very good and very important because they are meticulous and almost hypercritical of their own work, and they won't let anything pass. I mean, I know something on Penny Lane which wouldn't have made a scrap of difference to its hit potential anywhere. But Paul rang me up at the very last moment and said that he wanted to make one small alteration. And he made it. He got George Martin to help him make it. And although it wouldn't make any difference, it makes perfection. And this is all important.
This is what I've heard from another thing which they're doing. It's happening too. I mean, people are saying the most important thing is, are we pleased with it? You know, do we want it to go out? Because I think at least they have their own self-satisfaction and that they really believed it's a good record. I think that's probably very important
very much
to
so.
Them.
You know, just going back to the personal appearance thing, there is one thing that has to be said, that some people, in the concept of personal appearances as they are today, are terribly good at it. Now, the Beatles, although they've enjoyed tremendous success throughout the States and all over the world, their success on stage has been, I suppose, due to many factors, like any success is anyway. But they don't really think, and I don't think that they ever really thought that they were that great on stage. But it was more a projection and a personality that came over that made them great on stage, which they are unable to appreciate.
Mm-hmm.
But there are some people who are, in the concept of concerts today, great performers. I mean, I can name, say, The Cream, The Who, Jimi Hendrix. And especially for me, somebody that means a great deal is Cilla Black, who is good at being on stage. And Jerry, yes, also good. Tremendous personality and projection. Mm. And this was why originally I managed him. But I was going to mention that I hate, to a certain extent, mentioning my own artists, because it's fairly obvious that I think they're great, otherwise I wouldn't be managing them. But an act which is very well known here, and I had the pleasure to present in London, and I think one of the best concerts that I've ever attended was when, to only 1,200 people, which isn't a great many, in my own theatre, I presented The Four Tops. And this, for me, was one of the most exciting concerts. They are the grooviest people you could wish
right.
to present.
We've had them many times in our shows, and of course never had a few of our television shows, but never where they could do a complete concert.
No.
But I think this bears out what you had said earlier. It isn't that they made some records and all of a sudden they were going to go ahead and perform. They made that nightclub round for years. They used to travel with Billy Eckstein on tour and played all the finest supper
and
clubs.
And they are not an overnight success again.
No, everything they do is just timed. I don't know if they had Norman with them, their drummer. Did they have their own drummer?
Yes, they did. It was the second time, but not the first time. The first time was a promotional thing.
I see.
Which we were a bit unsure about.
Uh-huh.
But I knew that putting them into the Savile for two shows only, that we'd pack out and it'd be difficult to get tickets.
That's the one group that I would say utilizes its audience to the fullest extent. They
Absolutely.
Really reach out, and before you know it, the audience is really participating in part of everything they do. They feel as one. And very
well, I've seen several of their concerts because they've just been back again and done a second tour. But that first one will be unforgettable because it was within the confines of a small auditorium, and that was just too much.
There are certain, I guess, times and moments, I know I do too, and you must, that you remember. They were very exciting periods in the theater or in concert. I don't know what the expression is in England now as far as radio. Is it pretty much the same limitations or restrictions or attitude as it has been, say, in the past 2 or 3 years?
Well, I don't know. Maybe the BBC is, British Broadcasting Corporation, is getting a bit better. I don't know. Certainly, sound is better. Live sound is much better because there's much more understanding of what is required. But they've got some way to go. And certainly television has too.
Is the pirate radio station still operating?
The pirate radio stations are supposed to operate. I can't comment on that because I'm not involved, and B, I don't know where it is.
Uh-huh.
There was something about them coming off the end of March by order, and they're fighting away. So I don't know what's happening there.
There has been a tremendous amount of, both in, not only in Dylan, of course, who started, but a more recent album, Simon and Garfunkel, and a young lady who's 15 years old and writes and records all her own tunes by the name of Janice Ian. And I think this attitude of free expression and absolute honesty is, I think, a thing which, not a contrived honesty or contrived, blatant statement is I think the thing that's catching the fancy of our audience. I'd like to play something for you to hear because I think you may get a kick out of it.
This is
Janice Ian, and it's a tune that she wrote from her new album. It's called Janie's Blues.
That's nice. Very nice.
Yeah, for a young lady, I think she's says an awful lot in her album. We'll give you one to take back because I think
thank you.
She's got an awful lot to say. We can only say that we are just delighted to hear that, right from your mouth about the Beatles and about the overall attitude as far as where they're going and how they feel about certain things, and you yourself, how you feel about your continuation. A lot of people said that you were selling out your agency. I mean, there was a big rumor around here that you were selling out and you were just going to do all kinds of other things.
Sit in the grass.
Oh, yeah. I don't think you could do that, Brian.
No, I'm too gregarious.
Did you, is there any particular, let's see, you're involved with your own theater there, and of course the management of group. Now you have an organization which acts as an agency as well,
yes.
Right? And what about yourself? I mean, you were on TV, and your book was successful. And is there any other things that you, as an individual, are?
Yes, there are masses of things, but I'm very loath to get involved because I seem to, by nature, become involved in too many things. Which makes it difficult to concentrate on one thing. That's why I hope that with the new management agency operation which we have in London, which is quite considerable, that I can concentrate on the things that really concern me. And, one of them, just for example, that I got involved in, maybe I shouldn't have got involved in, that I'm going to make a film of the Seville Fair this year. But it won't be a big, important thing, but it'll be just a nice thing, I think.
There's so many goodies out there, isn't there, that you just, if you are creative and want to do things, you have to fight, you know, not to get involved. Mm. And that, of course, is a real hang-up. I, for one, want to thank you. I really enjoyed the visit. I was wondering whether or not there is anything before you go that you could tell us about in England as far as any changes. There seems to be, again, quite a different trend musically over there than here. It's been borne out, perhaps maybe by the type of exposure that a record like River Deep Mountain High got, that was so big in England and just did nothing here. And yet we're playing it here, and it's all that we're getting calls and letters and everything about that.
Yes, but this seems to work both ways, and it's something that I don't understand myself, because Trite Records, what you and I know as Trite Records, happen here and they happen in England. And one doesn't know why they don't happen in both. Mm-hmm. But the really great ones happen in both.
I had heard, and again I didn't know, it was just somebody's statement about rhythm and blues really coming into its own over there now. Is this something new, or is it true, or has it always been?
I think it's true, and I think it's always been. I've presented a lot of American artists at the Savile on these Sunday nights, people like Chuck Berry. Edwin Starr was a wow. I don't know how big he is here, but well, maybe I shouldn't say that, but he didn't have the best backing possible, but he was almost like a Levi Stubbs. You know, he got that audience, and he wasn't topping the bill. And people like that, like Chuck Berry, Duane Eddy, Fats Domino, is going to appear in my theatre for a week. This is the first visit he's ever made to England, and I'm very thrilled about this. These people will be appreciated, I hope.
Did Muddy Waters ever play England?
No, Bo Diddley.
Bo Diddley, then. Did, the one thing which I, just from a personal standpoint, which I'm cognizant of, and I think that the Beatles and yourself probably fall into the same boat. No matter where, after a while, let's say after the first opportunity that we had when they first came here, we actually went on out on the town in New York. You know, it never happened after that. But the first time, and we were able to go to Miami and take a day off. But after that, and I became very aware of it as time progressed, there are certain pressures that if I'm in this business now today, I'm in a radio station where my attitude and the station itself and the reasons I came back allow me to be myself and not
admirable, Murray. Not admirable. I like the show very much. I listened the other night.
Thank you.
Great.
And I think it has given me it's relaxed me, because if I don't really believe in saying something or doing something, if it hurts me as an individual, I won't do it. Like getting the boys to do a promo or someone to say this or someone to say that. Like, it started to get on me so badly that I really became sick and ill about it. And it got to a point, and I was an observer of it, that no matter what, whether it was the special police who were there to guard the Beatles and keep them away, people away, and let them get some relaxation and all, no matter who, there was always somebody wanting something from them or from you. It was always getting closer or knowing, but it would always end up, whether it be just an autograph or I have this or I have that, there was something that they wanted you to do, either for themselves or for somebody. And it got to be, it must be a very, very hard road to find yourself in that position, because every time you look around, it's somebody asking for something.
But I must say, if I've tried to do anything, I've tried to keep them away from all that and try to allow them to, as far as I can, live you know, contented lives, which to a certain extent they do, but they are, as I think, gregarious and want to do things. But it's a hang-up having to do things with terrific pressures, particularly when you don't understand the pressures, which is sort of a bit like 64. There was nothing the matter with 64. It was very thrilling. Mistake me. I was knocked out. But on the other hand, you know, you can't live like that forever.
Oh, it's true. That they never did lead, you know, any kind of normal life, and you didn't know after a while. It became like a political circle, you know. Certain people try to get in and weren't, and they were...
And they still do.
Yeah.
I mean, we still get asked to do incredible things.
Yeah.
You can hardly believe the offers and propositions which are made to me, which are just quite ridiculous, but it's made by persons with a complete lack of comprehension.
Is it true that you were offered $1 million, it was $1 million tour for a couple of shows?
I don't know how many $1 million it was that we were offered. I mean, I suppose I could look it up and you know, sure it's there in my files, just in case.
Because there were all kinds of stories, which you could all believe. I always remembered a scene in Nassau, and we were just talking. It was no interview or anything like that. And we were talking, Paul had said, if you promise not to say even the titles, I'd like to play something for you. And I said, well, fine, I'd love to hear it. And he played the album from the score from the picture, which I heard at the time. But he said, he can see it now in about 8 or 9 years. Everyone's sitting around and people talking about music, and someone says, oh, boy, let's get out the Beatle album. Mm. And the kid's saying probably, you know, a nephew or someone, the Beatles, here's your Beatles, down with the Beatles. I don't want that old-time music, you know. And this is what his own relationship, I mean, their attitude is.
Yeah.
Is, hey, well, okay, we're here, and yeah, I'm not worrying about tomorrow. They're not looking for eternal...
But it isn't that at all, because they do care.
Well, maybe it was the facade. Thank you. But... I think the future is going to be a very interesting one. I, for one, am looking forward with keen anticipation to get the album and hear what they're doing. And I'm delighted that everything is status quo as far as the relationship and their being together and you with
everything
them.
Is and everything was. There was not even so much as a row. That's the ridiculous thing about it. But it blew up into something. I get American press cuttings from our office here, and I read them, and some of them are syndicated throughout the country. One or two, I take the trouble to write back and say, you know, this is not quite true. In fact, I'm a bit sort of stronger than that. I said that was a load of rubbish, and I just want you to know it, particularly when I'm sort of personally hurt by it. But I just hope that Strawberry Fields and Penny Lane might prove a thing or two, and certainly the album's going to prove more than a thing or two.
Would you be I'd like to ask you about, like, for example, Tomorrow Never Knows, which is supposedly, again, I had been saying it without really the complete knowledge of the interpretation. Some of it was based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Is that correct?
I think so. All I know is that John was up in my house one day and he played this to me and I thought it sounded marvelous.
Is there any...
It doesn't really matter what a thing is based on or what it's about or analyzing things that people put on record, particularly music more than anything else. I mean, their music has been analysed, God knows, you know, sort of everywhere and by everybody. But it doesn't matter because it still provides something.
Well,
which
I think that before analyzing what they had done, let's say 64, but when they started writing and creating what I call attitude music, because it had, I think, one of the great Attitude songs. I did a film on She Can Work It Out, on the tune We Can Work It Out, and which was the freedom of trying to say, don't put it in a don't put a label on it because you're going to box it in, but there's two or three different interpretations of that lyric. And I recently showed a film with three screens, which gave both a comedic interpretation, light interpretation, a very heavy interpretation of it on a political level, and then an abstract one. And their music, I believe, this is what basically lyrics are. I mean, crystals, aren't they? You put them up to the light and you see whatever you want to see.
I mean, this is true of Penny Lane. I mean, Penny Lane is very personal. All of us lived near, very near, Penny Lane. And all of us know about the barber shop and the bank and so on. But this doesn't mean to say that this isn't going to provide a happy few minutes for people all over the place.
There's no prize, though, for guessing the right interpretation of a lyric or what it's supposed to mean. I think the idea is that if it entertains you or you get something of it, fine, you can interpret it that way. But I think the reason that, for example, I am more interested today, and a lot of people are more interested today, in not dissecting but getting a further insight into their expression of what they are trying to express, what they felt when they were doing it, what they wanted to express, is because that today, all over, and as I said before, they were the force that experimented. I've never seen a group that experimented so much and went from one record to another, and each time that they were saying something, but something very well, they did it very well. But I'm interested because today, musicianship, writing, lyrics are so different and so saying so much, and that where before a group was a group, today you begin to recognize certain instrumentalists because of their great ability to play. You start to recognize their musicianship and their or writing ability, and it's very interesting for me, and I know for the audience, to find out in what direction they were pointed in, whether or not it was just creating a song or creating it from some sort of experience.
Creating, well, I don't know, you know, and I don't think that I should really comment, but I suppose that it's creating a song at the time that they're creating it. And this being a good time for them, as was I Want to Hold Your Hand, presumably a good time for them, is just as important.
Well, I think there are many good times ahead for you and for the Beatles, and I want to thank you so much for taking all this time to spend with us tonight, and we trust that we'll, as we will before we hear a rumor, I like the opportunity, I'll call your office in England, and they'll tell me firsthand, because the Beatles are very much together, and Epi is very much together, and we're looking forward to a lot of very, very exciting things.
We'll try. I can only say that this is sort of an interview, I suppose you call it an interview, but it's been more like a chat, and it's been an as pleasurable, quote, interview, unquote, as I've ever had, anyway.
Well, thank you very much, Brian. Good night.